righty. When council are ready, you can settle yourselves. Number 2320140, Sullivan versus Feldman. We'll hear first from Mr. Melkonian.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Rafi Melkonian for the Feldman Capstone Appellants. My colleague, Mr. Heron, is going to address the Carlson appellant after I complete my presentation. Your Honors, this is a case about an arbitration procedure that went badly off the rails.
The what?
Arbitration procedure. The district court confirmed four essentially contradictory arbitration awards. It did so by ignoring or downplaying strict jurisdictional limitations on the arbitrator's power. That was improper, and the judgment below should be vacated and at the very least remanded for further proceedings. I'd like to talk about four issues today. I'm happy to take them in whatever order Your Honors would like, but my thought was to start with the subject matter jurisdiction issue floating around that we filed a supplemental brief on and our opponents have responded, and then move to the conflicting judgments issue, then the question of the four-month limitation and the single arbitrator limitation on the arbitrator's power, and then end with class arbitration. Hopefully we get there. So let me start with subject matter jurisdiction, because that's a threshold issue. I assume you're going to have to address it in your opinion. The way we read Badgerow, combined with the new Fourth Circuit Smart Sky opinion, is that when you file a petition to confirm, modify, or vacate an arbitration award, you are creating a new FAA action. That is the way we read Badgerow itself, and that is the gloss that Smart Sky puts on Badgerow, very clearly. The court says it's not like a motion in an existing case, it's a new action. So if that's true, then you have to have an independent jurisdictional basis for that new action. And the way we read Badgerow, you have to look at the face of the application. And again, whatever.
Badgerow was a case that was removed from state court, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's well known that you look at the face with a well-pleaded complaint. This was a case that came back, having already been before the district court at least once with complete diversity jurisdiction. Complete diversity jurisdiction exists today. 28 U.S.C. 1653 would probably allow any correction of any pleading deficiency. So I don't see your problem.
Let me address the last thing, or the second to last thing Your Honor said, which is complete jurisdiction exists today. I don't agree with that. I think that if you look at the application to confirm the Jones Award, as well as all the other awards, so there's 11 applications, I think, at the last stage, to confirm, vacate, do all sorts of things. If you look at those, there are non-diverse parties on both sides. So on the plaintiff's side, there are what are called the captive insurers. So that's the companies that are called things like Cerberus and things like that. And then on the defense side, there's the company Pool Ray, which is also a Delaware entity. And no one disputes any of that. What our friends on the other side say is that Pool Ray was never part of the Jones arbitration action. In other words, when they moved to confirm the Jones arbitration, they didn't include Pool Ray in the caption. Respectfully, I don't think that that works as a way to manufacture federal subject matter jurisdiction. I think you have to look through to the actual arbitration award that is being confirmed. And Judge Rosenthal issued a judgment with respect to Pool Ray in that opinion. There is an arbitration award that includes Pool Ray. There's relief awarded against Pool Ray. And so I think that that entity is in the case, whether we like it or not. And so if you're with me on how we read Badgerow, and you read Smart Sky the way we do, which is that there's a new FAA action, then I think the question is Pool Ray in the case? Because there's no question Cerberus is in the case. And then we have this jurisdictional problem. And the way I would say it, before I move on to the merits, is if our friends on the other side had filed a new action with the petition to confirm Jones, there's no question we would have to confront the subject matter jurisdiction issue. And so their theory is that by putting it into the pre-existing action, we can borrow the jurisdiction of the motion to compel proceeding, at which time there was diversity. And we don't think that that is how Badgerow can be read.
That's not how arbitration has ever worked, as far as I can tell.
There are examples, to be sure, where it's worked the other way, Your Honor. I'm not disputing that with you. What we say is that Badgerow creates a new rule. And if you read Smart Sky, the Fourth Circuit certainly thinks Badgerow creates a new rule. So let me just move on to my merits argument. First, these arbitration awards are directly conflicting. And in particular, the Jones and the Glasser Award are directly conflicting. So the starkest conflict, the one we've all talked about, is that Jones certifies a class action against the Feldman, Capstan, and parties. And then Glasser doesn't just say, I don't think there's a class action. That's what Judge Rosenthal said, that Glasser thought no class action, Jones thought yes class action. That's not what happened. Glasser reached into Jones's arbitration and decertified the Jones class action and forbade notice from being given. Those two awards can't possibly both be confirmed. It's as if, you know, one arbitrator said A and the other arbitrator said not A. And those are the cases that we cited. There's two cases that deal with exactly this problem in different circumstances, to be sure. That's the Roughneck case from the Seventh Circuit and Connecticut Light and Power from the Second Circuit. And in both of those cases, the judges said that we have to find a way to reconcile these completely irreconcilable arbitration awards. And I would say the same has to be done here. Now, what we would suggest, if you agree with us, is to vacate the judgment below and ask Judge Rosenthal to pick one of these arbitrations to find a way to confirm one arbitration so that it's consistent. Or what we've suggested to the district court is to have a final arbitration that decides essentially which is controlling.
I thought there was an arbitration underway about the conflicting awards.
We have initiated the arbitration. Judge Rosenthal told us to stop it, and so it has not proceeded. She did not issue a TRO. She told us if we did not stop, she would issue a TRO. So we stopped. We complied with the court's order. But we think that that would be a reasonable way to resolve this direct conflict in the arbitral awards. And our friends on the other side, I think...
I mean, isn't that essentially what she did? She picked an award and said, this is the one I'm confirming?
No, Your Honor,
well,
I think
I know she said she confirmed them all, but she entered a judgment consistent with one award and contrary to three others.
Right, so what I would say, I have two answers to that. One is, in that same final judgment, she says, I'm confirming all the awards.
Right.
So that is inconsistent with that.
Well, why do you think it would be any different if we vacate and then tell her to confirm one?
Well, I think she would then have to articulate how you can vacate the Glasser Award. And I don't think there's any basis to vacate the Glasser Award that would not also vacate the Jones Award. So for example, if you say, I have to vacate the Glasser Award because Mr. Glasser went past 4 months, that's one of the bases they could have. That's fine. But Jones also went past the four-month jurisdictional limitation. And so I think if the district judge were asked to explain how it could be that one is confirmed and the other isn't, I think that that would cause a difficulty.
And what would be the resolution of that?
So we think that if you follow through the single arbitrator provision, the best we can read it, you end up with Glasser. Because the way we read it, there's a chart in our brief at page 58. I know it's a difficult chart, but it tries to explain how all the claims end up with Glasser. And so the Kutcher and the Baker arbitrations went past their jurisdictional limit, the 4 month, and they were replaced by Glasser. And the demand to Glasser incorporates every possible claim between the parties. So we think that everything ends up in front of Glasser, or you could say, look, all of these arbitrators didn't follow their jurisdictional, you know, powers. They went past 4 months. We're going to vacate all of them. You could also do that. We think the right answer is Glasser, or maybe this ultimate arbitration that resolves all the arbitrations. But another solution is to vacate everything. Now, of course, that's a difficulty. It's a mess. But we are already in a situation where this case, unfortunately,
is a mess. Let me ask you a question. What has ever happened in regard to the tax consequences of these arrangements? Why the parties are, you know, that's what it instigated the arguments. So.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't know what the current status of all that is. What I know, I guess the way I would answer that question is that three of the arbitrators found there to be $1.7 million of actual damages.
Well, yeah, but they're talking about misleading in regard to the claims that were made about tax advantages and so on, but I thought I had read in one of the briefs that, in fact, not any of the plaintiff I forget whether they're plaintiffs or defendants, not any of the doctor groups had, in fact, been audited and found to have an invalid arrangement.
I think that's right. I'll consult with my colleagues and make sure that's correct.
Well, they can answer that.
When I come up for rebuttal, but I think that's right, but it's not really presented in the record evidence, I think. But let me finish my thought about the 1.7. That's the damages that were found. And I do want to note that three of the arbitrators agree that the damages are about the same. The outlier is the Jones arbitration, which suddenly comes up with $90 million. So we have three arbitrators that say the damages are 1.7. Then we have three arbitrators that say Mr. Carlson is blameless. And then we have this fourth arbitrator that hits him with $90 million. And I think that is the sort of symptom of the mess that this arbitration proceeding became. I think if everyone had followed the arbitration agreement as written, especially the four-month provision, we would have ended up with one arbitration award that, you know, we would be stuck with. There's not much we would have.
But the Feldman Group drafted the arbitration agreement, I suppose.
We did, Your Honor. There's no question about that. But I think, I don't think our friends on the other side have said they were tricked into it. They have counsel. They're very sophisticated.
No, I'm right.
So let me turn to the four-month provision. I know I've mentioned it a little bit, but let me talk about it a little. This arbitration agreement says that the award must be issued within 4 months of the time the demand is made. The Jones arbitration, and all the other arbitrations too, did not follow that rule. And they didn't miss it by a couple days or weeks, even a month. They didn't give themselves an extra 2 weeks or something to finish the arbitration. This arbitration dragged on for 23 months in total. And it ended with a four-person simultaneous arbitration in the same room where the arbitrators were giving differing rulings on evidentiary issues. They were sanctioning each other. It's an extraordinary proceeding. And I think if the four-month provision were followed, that would not have happened. And our best case on that is a case that happens to include some of the parties before us. It's the Poulray case from this court. And in Poulray, this court vacated an arbitration proceeding because of an error in the appointment process. The court didn't say, as our friends on the other side insist, that, well, don't worry, all of this is delegated to the arbitrator. They can ignore whatever jurisdictional limitations on their power they would like. And I think if that were the rule, that would be an extraordinary situation for arbitration in our circuit. To say that arbitrators need not follow the agreements the parties have entered for how they're going to resolve their dispute, I think that would lead us down a bad path of how arbitration works. So I would say, read Poulray. You'll see that there isn't delegation clause in Poulray. You have to look to the district court case, district court opinion, to see the delegation clause. But it's a full delegation clause. It's, like I said, it's the same, almost the same parties. They wrote the same kind of arbitration agreement. And this court nonetheless said that there was a violation of the powers of the arbitrator. You can also look to Smith v. Transport Workers. That's a case about delay in the delivery of an award. And there's other labor arbitration cases. where delay in the delivery of an award either caused the vacator of an award or the court said, well, no one complained, so it's okay. And we agree with that. If no one had complained, these arbitrators can go forward. But that's not the situation we have here.
You're saying that Feldman did complain about the 4 month.
Yes, Your Honor.
At least one of them, okay.
Yes, we complained vociferously throughout the process. We objected to when the four arbitrators jointly held the four-month restriction on their powers to be unconscionable.
What do you say about the district court having approved it?
The district court having approved?
The unconscionability ruling.
Well, I think the district court, I'm not sure the district court did approve it. I think in her opinion confirming these arbitrations, she simply says that these are delegated to the arbitrators, right, and therefore I don't have to worry about it. I think if she is asked to apply the four-month provision, I think that would be quite a different case, and we would have a merits argument about whether that was correct or not. Let me turn to class arbitration. As Your Honors know, Arbitrator Jones certified a class arbitration against the Feldman Capstone parties. Just at the simplest level, the arbitration agreement here does not contain any mention of class arbitration. And in fact, our opponents told a state court that the arbitration agreement as it's drafted is inconsistent with class arbitration. Because of course it is, it's only 4 months. There's no way to do a class arbitration in 4 months.
How many members are in the purported class?
Your Honor, I think it's upwards of 60. I don't remember the exact.
How many?
Upwards of 60.
60.
I'll get you the right number when I come back up, but I think that's the right answer. Now, our friends on the other side say, don't worry about any of that. There's these Fifth Circuit cases, especially Robinson, that says that a general delegation of arbitrability delegates class arbitrability to the arbitrator. And so Jones found class arbitrability, everything's fine. Our answer to that, our first line answer, is that this is not a Robinson case at all. There is a clear class action waiver in this case, a waiver signed by all the doctor's entities.
Yeah, but that's in a different agreement involving the setup of Pool Ray.
Yes, that is a different agreement involving Pool Ray. But the way I would say that, Your Honor, is imagine they had signed a separate class action waiver that applied to all disputes between the parties, not in another agreement, just class action waiver. That would certainly apply. I mean, the text of this class action waiver is very broad. It says we waive the right to class action in any kind of arbitration in any dispute between these parties. So I would say they have waived their right to class arbitration. Now, if you disagree with me on that, and you say, no, I can only look at the arbitration agreement to see whether a class arbitration has been agreed to. Now, first of all, as I pointed out, there's no mention of class arbitration anywhere. What do we do about delegation through the broad arbitrability clause? And the way I would answer that is to say, if you combine 2020 communications, that's the case of this court that held that class arbitrability is a gateway issue, with the Supreme Court's decision in Lamps Plus that says that class arbitrability cannot be delegated sort of by ambiguity. At the very most, this agreement does not delegate class arbitrability clear and unmistakably. At the most, they have ambiguity. I mean, there's no mention of class arbitration anywhere. And so I would say Robinson doesn't control. You read the arbitration agreement at the threshold as a gateway issue, and you see whether there is a basis for class arbitrability in this agreement. We say there's not. I don't know of any argument that there could be based on the text of this agreement. And so therefore, you have to vacate the arbitration provision. The class arbitration, which would result in vacator of the judgment.
Was this issue presented to the arbitrators?
Yes, Your Honor, it was presented to the arbitrators. But we still think it's a gateway issue for the court on the
motion. You have a record site on that? It's fine if you want to bring it up on rebuttal.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, did you ask if
you have a record cite for when this was presented to the arbitrators?
Each of the arbitrators that was presented with class arbitration issued an order saying, well, Medley and Jones issued orders saying we find class arbitration to be proper based on the arbitration agreement. I'll get you the record citation when I come back up, but it's in the Jones arbitration award, which I can give you. And, you know, there's a chart right at the beginning of our brief that sets out where the awards begin. It's in the second paragraph of that award from Jones.
Well, I think what he's asking is, did the Feldman parties contest class arbitration?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I'll give you a record citation if I can. Otherwise, I'll write a letter. Thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Herron.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Yes, sir.
I represent Jeff Carlson. Jeff Carlson has no agreement to arbitrate. His employer signed one before he worked there. He was a party to three arbitrations, and he won all three. Take nothing judgments. He was not a party to the fourth arbitration for Judge Jones. He still lost $90 million. He went to the district court to vacate it.
I mean, you pull him over with a feather, huh?
Yes, Your Honor. He went to the district court to vacate it, and the district court at the hearing said, when I attempted to argue, I view Mr. Carlson as the tail that should not wag the dog. In her opinion, she wrote that Mr. Carlson echoes the Feldman party's arguments. She did not even acknowledge that Mr. Carlson made his own arguments. She simply confirmed all of the awards and entered a $100 million judgment. So right now, Mr. Carlson has a life-changing liability, and he still doesn't know why. He doesn't know when he was sued in this arbitration.
Well, the argument, if I recall correctly, is that there was something in what Medley wrote that might have implicated Carlson, and then when Jones took over from Medley, there was something else that said, I'm doing everything that Medley did. And even though they never referred specifically to Carlson in any particular way, somehow it all slid through.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the timeline here is important. Originally, when Medley first started, Mr. Carlson obtained a temporary injunction barring it because he had no agreement to arbitrate. The doctor said, this is moot because we'll dismiss him. Later they said, it's moot because we'll dismiss him if certain things are done. And the state court didn't wait for the conditions to be met. They simply issued a temporary injunction. So then the doctors filed a motion to dismiss in Medley that was not ruled on. But they filed their third demand in Medley that did not assert any claims against Mr. Carlson. Now, the other side has taken some shifting positions on this issue. In the district court, they argued Mr. Carlson was never actually dismissed. Their second demand from Medley was live throughout this entire process, and they went to the arbitration on their 10th demand against everyone else and their second demand against Mr. Carlson. In this court, they don't advance that argument anymore. Now they say Carlson was gone but dismissed without prejudice when they filed their third demand in Medley. Then they filed their 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th demands in Jones, and he was still gone. Then they filed their 10th demand in Jones. It had a page-long list of respondents that did not include Mr. Carlson. And since Mr. Carlson was not a party at this time, he had no reason to even be served with or read this demand. But if you flip to the exhibits to the 10th demand, the final demand in Jones, it incorporates an old demand from Medley that asserted claims against Mr. Carlson and two directors of Poolery. And they say Mr. Carlson, who was not a party at this time, should have read the exhibit, should have decided from the exhibit that they were incorporating claims against him, and even though they apparently didn't come up with this argument until the appeal, he should have understood it better than they did, and he should have known he was a party. And Your Honor, I just don't believe that... Oh,
what led Arbitrator Jones to include Carlson?
Well, at the final hearing, one of the arbitrators asked, are you asserting claims against Mr. Which arbitrations are you asserting claims against Mr. Carlson in? And nobody knew off the top of their head. The doctor's counsel said, I'm not sure, I'll have to get back to you. Judge Jones said, I don't recognize his name, and I go through this quite a bit. Finally, there were combined briefs, so Carlson was in their post-hearing brief because he was a defendant in three of the arbitrations. Then finally, their proposed final award included Carlson. And that's how he ended up in the Jones Award, because he was in the proposed final award.
Right, right.
And at that point, there was nothing Carlson could have done. The arbitration was over. They were at the proposed award stage.
Right.
So that's part of why their argument about waiver is flawed, is they say that Mr. Carlson should have objected, but there's no way he could have objected because he didn't know. He knew he was a party in Medley. He objected. He got an injunction. You do what you're supposed to do. And by the time he was supposedly re-added to Jones, he had no way to know that.
Right.
And I see I'm running out of time, so I want to very briefly hit on my final 2 points. For direct benefits estoppel, which is, again, the district court didn't say why Mr. Carlson is bound. She just bound him. Direct benefits estoppel is the only argument that was seriously advanced. And so far, neither side has ever cited a case from anywhere in the country that applied direct benefits estoppel to a non-signatory defendant. It's all this court has said courts only seriously consider it with a non-signatory plaintiff.
Okay.
I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. All right, Mr. Friedman.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Just to answer a few of the questions that came up during the appellant's arguments, there were 141 class members. If I may.
Who had 24 hours to opt in or opt out, right?
That there was a second opt-out that was opened. Actually, the original notice went in February of 2021. The period extended to July. So I don't think it is correct that they only had 24 hours to opt in, opt out. The record has opt-out periods that went. The 24-hour period, Judge Jones, that you're referring to, was due to an issue of Mr. Fellman signing opt-out forms on behalf of class members that had never authorized him to do so, which opened up the opt-out period for an additional 24-hour period to resolve that issue. But the actual opt-out period itself was...
Let me ask, I'm a little unclear on the what generated this conflict, because I understand the doctors feel they were misled, but they were misled about tax consequences because Pool Ray was determined by the tax court to be not tax-advantaged, right?
I think that was the genesis of the original dispute that was before Judge Dorfman. So what happened was, because of the tax consequences of a 2018 decision that basically held the Feldman captive program to be a sham, the doctors started to ask to exit the captive space, liquidate our captives. They were told that was impossible, even though that turned out to not be correct. And we have arbitrator awards saying that. The representations that kept coming were, you can't get out of this captive space as long as there are liabilities on your captive insurance companies that still need to be resolved. The doctors continued to ask, what are those liabilities?
Yeah. Feldman's liability.
They wouldn't tell us, though. Yeah. We had to get at least 5 orders on motions to compel, okay, contempt motions. When we finally get the information, there's the discovery in middle of August of 2020. You know, more than, you know, in the middle of the first final hearing, that a lawyer has required his clients to reinsure his malpractice liabilities. And I say reinsurance, but it's undisputed there was no primary malpractice coverage. So, and it's, I think the vexatious litigiousness are well documented. These were
right.
Substantial liabilities, which generated the class action claim. Is everyone in this pool, the 141 clients, were all unknowingly subjected to being forced to pay for the Feldman parties.
Are those individual doctors or groups?
There's groups. It's 14 different groups of closely related entities through 14 different captive insurance companies, but they are 141 clients, and when the Feldman parties have sued them in the past, I mean, the record shows in a year and a half period from 2018 to 2020 alone, 50 clients were named as defendants, and the Feldman parties profited in those litigations to the tune of $3.3 million converted from their clients' funds. Again, none of that is discovered without the arbitrators declaring the 4-month clause unenforceable. And the reason they declared it unenforceable is because of the unconscionable breaches of, you know, arbitrator order after order, turn over the documents, what liabilities are preventing the closure of these captives. The arguments, the just complete ignoring of arbitrator order, contempt orders, turn over the documents, and the Feldman parties refused to do that. So I think if the Feldman parties wanted to insist on their four-month clause, which they don't do in every arbitration, just as an aside, even the Dorfman arbitration they sought to confirm took 6 months. But putting that aside, if a party wants to insist on its four-month arbitration provision, I think it's incumbent upon the party to arbitrate in good faith and to comply with arbitrate orders, especially in the circumstances here where the arbitrators are operating under probably the broadest and most extensive arbitration clause and delegation clause ever drafted by man. It looks like font 8 or 10. It's single-spaced. It's full-page arbitration clause that could not go further in divesting courts of any powers in the parties' disputes. It couldn't go further in delegating all issues of arbitrability to the arbitrators to decide. It couldn't go further in delegating all issues regarding the appointment of the arbitrators to the arbitrators to decide. And perhaps most importantly for the four-month clause provision, it couldn't go further in delegating any and all disputes or issues regarding the enforceability of the arbitration agreement to the arbitrators to decide. That brings us squarely to the Supreme Court's decision in Rent-A-Center West v. Jackson. In that decision, Justice Scalia writes that it's footnote 3 I would direct the court's opinion to in Justice Scalia's opinion there, where Justice Scalia notes that even the dissent agrees that the invalidity of one provision in an arbitration clause does not necessarily invalidate the rest of it. He says there's no magic bonds that tie a provision in an arbitration clause to the others that would prevent them from being severed. In that case, it was unconscionability challenges to explicit discovery limitations in the arbitration clause, as well as fee-splitting provisions. And like any other agreement to arbitrate, you know, arbitration is a matter of contract. What the Supreme Court said in Rent-A-Center is parties can agree to delegate those enforceability or unconscionability challenges to the arbitrator.
But they also said that delegation of class matters cannot be ambiguous.
That was in Lamps Plus, Your Honor, where it is undisputed the parties agreed to have a court decide that question.
I don't think Lamps Plus turns on that. It still says it has to be unambiguous. And this court also said it's a gateway issue for decision by the court.
Unless there's clear and unmistakable intent to delegate that issue to the arbitrators. And I would bring up Oxford Health Plans v. Sutter, which couldn't be closer to our decision, where the Supreme Court found similar language in arbitration clause to delegate class arbitrability to the arbitrators. I would raise this court's decisions in Robinson, Reed, at least the first half of Reed, even Judge Ho, your most recent opinion in Suncoast, which again found delegations of class arbitrability. You know, when the parties agree to delegate that issue of class arbitrability to the arbitrators, the courts must respect and enforce that agreement. This brings up an issue in Suncoast that Judge Ho, you had asked a question about whether the parties had submitted these class arbitrability issues to the arbitrators. And I would point out, yes, they did. First to Judge Medley, there was a motion for class cert filed. It's in the record 4348. There was a hearing on class certification that was more than a month later. It's in the record at 4232. At that transcript, you'll see that not only was, when the doctors moved to certify a class before Judge Medley, there was no opposition filed. It was part of what the
Nobody opposed the arbitration.
Nobody opposed. There was no They articulated opposition at the hearing after refusing to comply with the scheduling order as to when to file an opposition. There was no opposition more than a month after the motion to class cert had been filed by the Feldman parties. The order on certifying class was 4344. There was a supplemental class order, 5056. And then this was what the call for arbitration agreement would have allowed the Feldman parties to do had they wanted to challenge that class cert and clause construction award issued by Judge Medley. The AAA supplementary class action rules, which are incorporated and apply to our agreement, clearly delegate class arbitrability to the arbitrators.
They're not explicitly incorporated.
The arbitration clause does say that all arbitrations, All arbitration shall be conducted in Houston, applying Texas substantive law pursuant to the AAA commercial arbitration.
I understand, but AAA doesn't necessarily mean supplemental class. And the reason I say that is LAMPS Plus. This has to be delegated explicitly. This arbitrating a class is a very big deal compared to arbitrating a two-party dispute. And it was very hard for me to believe that AAA, you know, an appendix to AAA can overcome Supreme Court authority about this kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I understand your intuition here, Judge Jones. I would. The Oxford Health Plans v. Sutter case, we feel, is squarely on point here. That's a Supreme Court decision that found that parties can agree to delegate class arbitrability to the arbitrator. The arbitration delegation clause there was not even as close to as extensive as the delegation clause here. I would point to this court's decision just of May 28th of this year. This court just issued an opinion in Work v. Intertech Resource Solutions. And what this court said just in May of this year, less than 2 months ago, if I'm correct, is that incorporation of the JAMS rules constituted clear and unmistakable intent to delegate the class arbitrability issue to arbitrators. There is no meaningful difference between the delegations in the JAMS rules and those of the AAA rules. And in fact, I would point to the language in the first half of this court's Reed decision, where the court found that incorporating the AAA rules also brought with it the AAA supplementary class action rules. But again, Judge Jones, I understand your intuition here. It comes back to, I think there's a really persuasive case out of the 11th Circuit called JPay. We cite it a lot in our brief. When parties have agreed to delegate any and all, every issue under the sun to the arbitrators to decide, as our arbitration clause does here, there's no reason to then go forth and say that includes issue A, issue B, issue C. The parties have delegated everything to the arbitrators to decide. At that point, I think what the 11th Circuit says, it would be a useless activity in needless contract writing to then go forth and specify everything you're delegating when the party's intent clearly on the face of the clause is to delegate everything.
Well, so, all right. So I have your argument unless you want to say more on that issue. And here, everything was delegated, so you end up with your side filing several arbitrations, their side filing several arbitrations. This ridiculous proceeding with four interlocutors or arbitrators fighting among themselves, granting and overruling different issues and so on. You're happy with that, right? But you end up with totally conflicting rulings. Now, your brief attempts to say that they're not conflicting, but I would like to hear your argument about how could the district court justify selecting one, the outlier ruling in her judgment when she purportedly confirms all of them?
Yeah, I understand. And admittedly, this is not an area of the law where there is a lot of jurisprudence in it. I think there's a reason for that I'm happy to address. I mean, typically parties draft arbitration clauses in sensible ways.
Well, I don't care about the genesis of it. We know there's no law. But what kind of law justifies selecting the outlier award at the expense of the other three?
So what we analogized it to, and again, there's not a lot of jurisprudence here, and we don't understand our opponents to have a solution to this problem you're presenting either. They just say, pick the most favorable to them. What we've analogized it to is an election of remedies. We are operating under an arbitration clause that all but guaranteed this proliferation.
Well, three of the awards did not allow class action.
In two of them, the issue was never even submitted, Judge Jones.
It doesn't matter. They didn't allow it.
No one ever asked them to rule upon the issue. It was never submitted to Judge Baker, Arbitrator Kusher, to rule on the class.
So then you have one that said absolutely not and one that said okay.
So they couldn't, well, so as to Jones and Glasser, again, this comes to the standards for confirming or vacating. And I understand what Your Honor is saying, but This is the Supreme Court's decision in Hall Street Associates. This court has followed the clear instruction from that case repeatedly in Kemper, in Citigroup Markets v. Bacon, in BNSF Railway. There are only four statutory grounds to vacate an arbitration award. There's only two grounds to seek modification under Section 11, and they are exclusive.
Well, do the arbitrators exceed their authority if they cannot agree?
See, that's and we've cited some cases that no, they do not. Inconsistency is not a basis for finding.
Who's going to send the sheriff out to enforce a $90 million award?
I think that is an enforceability issue.
That's a big issue. Well, how can we issue a judgment? How could Judge Rosenthal issue a judgment that is probably very unlikely to be enforceable?
I think it is enforceable under the Election of Remedies Clause. And look, I think the answer here is, you know...
She didn't reason it that way, though.
Well, it was definitely presented in our papers. It was.
But she didn't write on that, did she?
She confirmed all awards
She
did not reason election remedies, but that is the basis upon which the doctors asked her to do what she did. And
she couldn't explain it. I mean, Judge Rosenthal is very smart and very careful about things. And, you know, she said, I have no authority to not confirm these awards according to her interpretation of the FAA. And then she hauls off and issues the judgment that's totally inconsistent with the others.
I would point to, I mean, again, this is something that we do cite the Northern District of California case of 23andMe, where a court refused to vacate a class action arbitration award when there had been a prior arbitration award on the same contract saying you couldn't have it. And again, it just comes down to arbitration is a matter of contract. It may not be the best solution for everything. Inconsistency is a risk that comes.
Well, I'm just afraid that, you know, one way or another, this will end up in arbitration to resolve the difficulties in the conflicting awards. And then you will come back to the court again. And then we will be up here again.
Your Honor, that I can't guarantee that won't happen. That may very well be the case. All I can say is when you're at the confirmation or vacater phase of the litigation, there are only four grounds to vacate an arbitration.
I understand that, but I don't see how the court can issue an award that by definition is highly unlikely to be enforceable. I mean, it's one thing to have for the court to issue a judgment that they know can't be collected. But theoretically, the sheriff or the marshal will go out and, you know, take the assets away, and even though they can't completely collect the judgment. But here, you're not going to get a marshal who will say, I'm going to go and seize the assets of the Feldman Law Firm, because they'll get the pantsuit off them.
Your Honor, well, I understand the intuition. If parties...
It's not an intuition.
No, I understand the issue.
Yes.
What I mean to say is, if parties don't want this, and look, it comes back to the arbitration clause these parties agreed on, the arbitration clause the Feldman parties drafted. And it's not just our case. We see this proliferation of arbitrations with the Feldman parties in the jurisprudence constantly, and the record has it, too.
Well, you guys played hardball, too.
We had no choice, Your Honor, under you know...
I'm just saying.
No, I understand, but again, it comes down to the fundamental principle that arbitration is a matter of contract, and there are 100,000 ways that parties can draft around to avoid this type of result. But that's not the type of arbitration clause the Feldman parties wanted, and it's not the type of arbitration clause they drafted. And arbitration may be inefficient and messy, it may have these risks, but again, the Federal Arbitration Act mandates that courts have to compel the agreements as they're written and can only vacate these awards
well,
in the limited circumstances presented.
Well, and you know, I have two experts in con law on either side of me, but as a litigator and a person interested in Article 3, I do not see how the court can issue a judgment that has no legs.
We would respectfully disagree that this judgment has no legs. And again, the analogy we always come back to is...
Well, suppose she had just said, I confirm all four awards. Now, pox on your houses, go and figure it out with your next arbitration.
I think, you know, under the law of confirmation and vacatur, there was not a ground to vacate Judge Jones.
I didn't say vacate.
So she did confirm them all, and I think...
Yes, but she doesn't enter judgment.
I think that gets into issues of enforceability that are not presented respectfully by this appeal. There are issues of enforceability that...
Well, to me, it goes to Article III power, but, maybe I'm just wrong. So I don't want to take any more of your time.
The only way to say that the arbitration awards due to inconsistency should have been vacated is to respectfully, to jurisprudentially create a fifth ground for vacatur that is not in the plain text of the Federal Arbitration Act. It is not in Section 10. It is not in Section 11. And we have cases. There's the Southern District of New York case that found that even where two arbitration awards are irreconcilable, if they both draw their essence from the arbitration contract, they both must be confirmed. And maybe the answer, maybe the answer is in future enforcement proceedings where the parties brief arguments like election of remedies. I mean, I've never understood a party cast in judgment to elect which of the remedies the prevailing party gets to choose. That's not how that doctrine works. But that may be future briefing that the district court will have to work through in enforcement proceedings.
I'm not sure that the district court is the forum to answer any of this at this point.
I would submit that the arbitration clause itself, as extensive it is, does save to the district court the jurisdiction to enforce and to assist the parties in enforcement. It is one of the only grounds that is saved to a court. And there's a Second Circuit decision that says when a district court confirms an arbitration award.
Suppose the district court had confirmed the Glasser Award. Would that still be your position up here?
If she had confirmed the
enter judgment based on the Glasser Award or the Kutcher Award.
I think if it was the Glasser Award, we would have appealed. We would have raised the arguments we raised below as to why that award should have been vacated.
Well, you're basically saying she had the authority to enter judgment based on whatever award she wanted.
Well, our position would be, Judge Jones, is that we had the right to elect upon the remedies granted to us under a contract that gave this right and resulted in this, in the inconsistent awards that are presented before us.
And if you have any more to say, feel free. I am very interested in how you can hold Carlson bound.
Yeah, and I wanted to address that, but I didn't want to. Let me start there. Mr. Carlson, he just represented, and they've represented their papers, that he was a party in the Glasser Award. I would encourage the panel to look through all of the Glasser arbitration demands. There's five of them.
Well, I have to say, I read the briefing a couple of weeks ago, to be fair, but doggone it, I do not see how you can maintain with a straight face that something that was buried in the Medley papers when Carlson got an injunction removing him from that arbitration somehow reared its head at the very end, that even arbitrator Jones didn't seem to realize. And suddenly he's liable for $90 million. I just do not understand that. And I do not understand the justice of the position. I understand you may think he's a big fraudster too, but there were probably other individuals you could have filed, included. So I just don't understand.
So I'm happy to address, but let me start with, I understand where you're coming from, Judge Jones, and I think the answer where you're going with that is the argument Mr. Carlson's made that the claims were not submitted to Judge Jones. If that's what you're on—
Well, he wasn't a party to the agreement either.
That gets into a direct benefits estoppel. He did sue on the contract us.
He joined in the Dorfman thing because that's the only one he joined.
He also filed the Baker arbitration. He's a named claimant in that. And according to their arguments, he filed the five arbitration demands before Glasser. So he was a claimant in those arbitrations, according
to... But not in Jones. He got out of Jones.
This is the point I'm trying to make, though, is if you look at those Glasser demands, he is not named as a claimant in any of them, but they're still saying that he's a party there. And the only way they can get there is by the same type of adoption by incorporation that we're saying, and ours is adoption by corporation and attachment, that they're saying shouldn't apply. I would point to this court's decision in Forsyth International, where this court states that we're...
But then all the other arbitrators held he was... Okay, I'll read your briefs again on that score, but it's still hard for me. I thought they made a pretty persuasive case that you didn't respond and your side had changed its position several times about him. Moving on to the question whether the Jones arbitration legitimately included him, I don't understand that at all.
And if that is where, if I can't persuade you otherwise through an adoption by incorporation or the fact that Mr. Carlson signed a stipulation in the Jones arbitration or the fact that his liability was extensively briefed in the pretrial brief at the 24-day hearing where he said he was a defendant, in the post-trial briefing and in the proposed award, where there was then a four-month period of time where he could have said, I object, I'm not there, but before the...
In Jones?
Correct, Your Honor.
When was his last brief filed in Jones?
It is my recollection that it was December of 2021 when proposed awards...
But I thought post-award.
Correct. So.
But he had gotten an injunction not to be in the Jones arbitration.
He got a TRO.
All right.
But not against the Jones award, against the Medley arbitration a week before it was set to go to a final hearing. And but the doctors said, if you look at their papers, we will agree to dismiss him if we can proceed with our final hearing on December 8th. We were trying to moot an issue so we could go forward after litigating in this procedural nightmare. We were trying to go forward with a final hearing and try to moot an issue, not without prejudice, we'll dismiss him if we can go forward with our final hearing. But that condition never came to fruition, and the motions to dismiss Carlson and Medley were actually never even acted upon. We said we will dismiss him if we can go forward with our hearing December 8th.
Well, Judge Jones, I keep calling him Judge, Arbitrator Jones didn't seem to know he was in there.
There's a comment in the middle of a 24-day hearing that he was unclear about it. It's not in the record, so I won't, but it was cleared up and the parties briefed it extensively after the hearing, his liability, and they did so without a peep from Carlson. But, Your Honor, I understand I'm probably not winning this argument with you now that the claims of Carlson were submitted to Judge Jones. If that's where this panel is landing on this, that is not a Section 10 vacatur argument. That is explicitly a Section 11B, an arbitrator decided a claim not submitted to him. That's the language of Section 11B, which is a modification of an arbitration award. So if this panel is not persuaded that the claims against Carlson were submitted to Jones, we would ask this court, as we made clear in our papers, you can sever Carlson out. It doesn't change the liability that the Feldman parties were found. One thing, I'm running out of time, but I think it is important to note here the context in which the relationship between these parties, the fiduciary client, attorney-client relationship that we're talking about here, that through weaponized arbitration clause that they have drafted to allow the fiduciary to escape full accountability based on, you know, Mr. Carlson, we respectfully submit would be an injustice. You know, it is without doubt, I mean, all four arbitrators, even two unilaterally handpicked by the Feldman parties themselves, have found that the Feldman parties have egregiously breached fiduciary duties and stolen more than $3.3 million of their clients' funds held in trust. And if your honors are troubled by the fact that Mr. Carlson was found non-liable in three arbitrations and liable in the fourth, and it seems to be under the argument they've made that the claims were not submitted to Judge Jones, then the appropriate remedy would be a Section 11B modification of the award. We've cited cases like this court's decision. I believe, Judge Smith, you authored it in Smith v. It's the Union Workers of America case that says it allows this court the authority to vacate the aspect of the award that is problematic. There's the Third Circuit decision in Swiffy Industries that held the same. There's the Ninth Circuit's decision in Comedy Club where there was non-parties enjoined by the arbitration award. They kept the arbitration award and severed out the non-parties who shouldn't have been there. There's a lot of decisions out there that to say that you shouldn't throw away everything just because one party may not have been party or bound to that arbitration. So we would ask this court to, if it has problems with Carlson, sever. We stand on our briefing that we think incorporation by reference and adoption plus all the parties' conduct after the pleadings were more than sufficient to put Mr. Carlson on notice. It's the Forsyth International case of the Fifth Circuit that we're not supposed to superimpose rigorous procedural requirements in arbitration. That's part of the reason people
can't abandon all requirements, and this spectacle is ridiculous.
I understand, Your Honor, and if that's where this court is landing, then we would submit the appropriate remedy as a Section 11B modification for ruling on a claim not submitted to him.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Melkonian.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me address a few of those issues, as many as I can in the 5 minutes that I have. First, our friends on the other side blame the Feldman Capstone parties for misconduct, and that's why the four-month provision couldn't be followed. First of all, that's not an answer to the strict application of the four-month provision. But even if it were, if indeed the Feldman Capstone parties were committing misconduct in these arbitrations, the answer is the arbitrator has tons of power to sanction the Feldman Capstone parties, do whatever else they need to do. But they need to finish the arbitration within 4 months. That's what the contract says. And they have no explanation for why that was not done. With respect to the conflicting arbitration award point, Judge Jones, you're exactly right. We're not asking for the arbitrations to be vacated on that basis. We're saying the judgment is flawed. You can't have a judgment that says both X and not X. And you have to find a solution to that. That's what Roughneck says. That's what Connecticut Light and Power says.
And again, so what is your solution to reconciling four inconsistent awards?
So we have two possible solutions, Your Honor. One is you vacate the judgment below, remand to Judge Rosenthal, and instruct Judge Rosenthal to apply the other provisions to see which of these arbitrations is valid. So, for example, the four-month provision or the single arbitrator provision. That's one solution. Another solution is the one we initiated, is to say, look, none of these arbitrations are confirmed at this time. There needs to be an arbitration to decide which of these is the correct arbitration, the one that ought to be confirmed ultimately. So we think either of those would be a possible solution to this difficult problem.
Rather than trying to reconcile the four as the district judge seemed to try to do.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think the district judge has power to do that, to try to meld them into one somehow arbitration. And I think she recognized that by confirming all four of them. And we presented to her after she confirmed them, look, you've done this kind of melding that's incorrect. And she said, no, I have confirmed all four, including Glasser. I have given you a judgment on Glasser. That is her ruling. Now, our friends on the other side say, don't worry about that. We have election of remedies. This is not an election of remedies. Election of remedies is multiple consistent awards entered by one fact finder. And so they get to pick the best one. We agree with that. Of course, that's what election of remedies is. This is inconsistent awards entered by different fact finders. I have not seen a case anywhere in the United States, state or federal court, that says anything like that is appropriate. They cite some res judicata cases that say that inconsistent arbitration awards can sometimes both be confirmed. I agree. So if there's party A sues company X, and the arbitrator said, and there's a delegation clause, Arbitrator says class arbitration is okay. And then party B sues party X. And a second arbitrator says no class arbitration. I agree. You're stuck with that. That is not what we're doing here. We have one judgment where the one arbitrator vacated the other arbitration, and this arbitrator said, I'm going ahead anyway. That's not the same thing at all. With respect to class arbitration, they cite the relatively recent Intertech case that says incorporation of the JAMS rules also incorporates, delegates class arbitration. We think there is a significant difference in the text of the JAMS rules to the AAA rules. It's not a rule of orderliness issue. If you look at the JAMS rules, they say that the arbitrator is delegated the power to decide which parties are before it, very specifically. You could theoretically read that as a delegation of class arbitration. But I think the answer is that LAMPS Plus tells us that you must delegate class arbitrability clearly and unmistakably, not with any sort of ambiguity. They also cite Oxford Health as being definitive on the notion of class arbitration. As Justice Alito pointed out in his concurrence in Oxford Health, it was not disputed in that case. Everyone agreed that class arbitration had been delegated. So that is not a holding. It's LAMPS Plus and 2020 Communications are the cases, and I think those are the issues. That's what you need to apply. As for the Carlson issue, they never asked for modification, and that order is indivisible with respect to Carlson and us. With that, Your Honor, I ask this court to reverse the judgment.
What was your second instruction? You said none of the arbitrations are confirmed. Well, I have two questions.
Yes.
And I have a final arbitration. How do we know there wouldn't end up being four final arbitrators?
Your Honor, that is a problem if the parties behave in the same way.
Surely the parties here will stop paying lawyers at some point.
Okay. Your Honor, I guess that's my answer, is that this has dragged on so long, I think there's strong incentives to finish this litigation.
Second thing is, you said alternatively, vacate the judgment and instruct Judge Rosenthal to do what?
To try to pick one of the arbitrations to confirm, or at least to confirm consistent arbitrations. In other words, I don't think Judge Rosenthal can possibly confirm both Glasser and Jones. It's conceivable she could confirm, I don't know, Baker and Kutcher or something like that.
How is that any better than what she did here? I mean, this is a morass either way.
Well, I think we think that if she goes through the single arbitrator provision, you know, applying it the way we think it ought to be applied, you end up with Glasser. Because Glasser is the one that has all the claims before him first. So we think it ends up with Glasser. They don't agree. We understand that.
Well, it's slippery.
It's very difficult, Your Honor. But we think that Judge Rosenthal could get to an answer if she had to.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court is in recess.